Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Well, it is butterfly time at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California. The Mars rover Spirit is due to touch down or bounce its way to stability on the surface of the planet Mars tomorrow evening. So there are likely more than a few flutters in the stomachs of the scientists awaiting that particular moment. Spirit is the first of the two American Mars rovers set to land there this month in search for evidence of water. The landings come as European scientists are still waiting for news from their Mars explorer, the Beagle 2. A few months back, we spoke with the lead scientist for the European mission and heard the enthusiasm then in Colin Pillinger's voice.
This little beast can crawl across the surface and burrow under rocks, and I defy big rovers to do that.
Today, as Colin Pillinger and his colleagues are in their eighth day of trying to find any sign of contact from the Beagle 2, we look ahead at the prospects for the two American rovers and beyond them, ask what it is that fuels the search for life on other planets. Why are people on Earth still willing to pour billions of dollars into the search for water or even microbial Martians? Is it money well spent? What do you think? And would your world change if scientists could finally offer proof, however microscopic, that we are not alone? Our number here is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And I have the comfort of knowing that I am not alone on today's program. Kelly Beatty is with me here, our resident expert on what's up there. He's executive editor of Sky and Telescope magazine, has been covering planetary exploration for 30 years, also coming out with a new magazine called Night Sky, debuting this spring. Kelly, nice to have you back.
Always a pleasure, Dick.
And joining us from the NPR studio in Chicago, astrobiologist David Grinspoon. He's principal scientist at the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado, and author of the new book, Lonely Planets, The Natural Philosophy of Alien Life. David, nice to have you on the program.
Good morning.
And we have just been joined on the phone by Stephen Squires. He is the principal investigator for the Mars Exploration Rover Project. He's one of those people experiencing the butterflies in Pasadena, California at this moment. Stephen, it's nice to have you on the program.
Nice to be here. Hi, Dave.
Hey, how you doing, Steve?
Good.
And Kelly, you and Stephen know each other as well?
Yes, we do. Old compatriots.
Hey, Kelly, how are you?
Fine, Steve. Thanks.
Stephen, I'm wondering what the latest news is in Pasadena. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it what have you got for us?
It's good. We got a healthy spacecraft bearing down on Mars right now. We'll be down on the surface in less than 48 hours, and things are looking good right now.
Now, 2 billion miles it traveled? Am I right with that?
No, it's not that much. It's measured in the hundreds of millions, but it's still a real big number.
I can't even imagine how you're staying in touch with it at this point. How do you know that what you've got out there is still, you know, in some good shape?
We're in regular radio contact with both vehicles, actually. We have regularly scheduled radio contacts with them. We send commands. The spacecraft send back telemetry about their health, their status. We're tracking them in great detail, and they're doing right. They're doing just great right now.
Now, the moment of truth is still ahead, though, right?
I mean,
the landing is the big deal, right?
Well, the landing is one of several big deals. Launch was a big deal. We got that behind us now. We got landing, and that is a big deal. But the point of this mission is not just getting down on the surface. Once we have landed, that's another major milestone behind us. But then at that point, we got to get these rovers stood up, ready to move. It's going to take more than a week to get ready to drive off the lander. And then once we got 6 wheels in the dirt, we've got months of exploration ahead of us.
So late Saturday night, you may know that you're on the surface of the planet, but you won't know for a number of days whether or not the Spirit's actually going to be able to move around.
That's correct. It's going to take a period of days for us to kind of stand up, open our eyes, look around, and get ready to go.
Yeah, for people who remember the Mars Pathfinder mission back in 97, this will play out quite a bit the same in that, you know, it won't just land and ta-da, we have found life or we have found this or that. This is a mission that's going to play out over several weeks at 2 different sites. It's a very complex mission from that standpoint, and I think we ought to just be in it for the long haul.
Yeah, in fact, I would say more, it's going to play out over a number of months.
The very notion that you have two going down there, Stephen, is that because there's a risk that one might not give you the information, or is it in fact two different types of missions that you've got going there?
Well, the two vehicles are identical. They're as identical as we could make them, but they are in fact doing two very different missions because we're sending them to two very different places. The purpose of this mission is to help learn whether or not Mars ever had conditions at its surface that might have been suitable for life. We're sent in Spirit to a place where we think there might have been a deep lake long ago, and then we're sending Opportunity to a place where we see a mineral called hematite that forms usually on Earth when liquid water is around. They're two very, very different landing sites. And so we're really – Mars is such a diverse planet that if you can send two vehicles to two very different places, you can essentially double your science return. Now, of course, a significant additional benefit of that is that we do have two chances for a successful landing, and that's a good thing too.
David Greenspoon, do you want to hop in here? I'm just wondering if you've got a question for Stephen. It's a pretty key moment in the search for
The real question I would ask Steve if he and I were alone right now and I was passing him in the hallway at JPL was, hey, how you doing, buddy? How you holding up?
You know, I am doing just great, Dave. A lot of people have been asking me that question. And you know, how you feel at a moment like this really comes down to what you believe in. I mean, and we've done everything that we can do. We've done everything we possibly can to prepare. It now comes down to whether or not we believe these things are going to succeed. And I do, and the reason I believe in them is because I believe in the team that built them. We had just an incredible, incredible team here at JPL putting these things together. These are two of the finest spacecraft ever built. And sure, Mars could still get us. You know, a bad gust of wind at the wrong moment or a sharp pointy rock in the wrong place could kill us. But I'm feeling real good right now.
You know, listeners, you've not really seen Stephen much on television, but you will in the coming days. I'm convinced with someone with this much enthusiasm and energy could power the rovers remotely if he had to get them over whatever obstacles they might face. This mission couldn't have a more enthusiastic lead scientist.
I would second that.
Steve, I'm wondering what you're thinking about the Beagle people.
Oh, man. You know, I'm praying for them. You know, I've been there. I've been through lost spacecraft. I know how it feels. It's not time to give up on Beagle by any stretch. There's a bunch of things that can go wrong when you're trying to communicate with a vehicle on the surface of Mars. They've still got chances ahead of them. I'm hoping and praying that they're going to get their spacecraft back and they're going to have a long and successful mission. We'll see how it goes.
But Spirit and Opportunity are not going to be able to sort of peek over the next crater.
No. It's Mars, a big place. I mean, the total surface area of Mars is the same as the total land area of Earth. So it's a pretty big place. Beagle came down quite far from where we're going to be. So we can't do anything to help them, but, boy, we're sure rooting for them.
Now, Stephen, we'll talk further with Kelly here about how we actually can stay abreast of what's happening with Spirit and Opportunity. I know you've got a really, really busy couple of days ahead of you. Well, probably a couple of months ahead of you if all goes well. So I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Good luck, Steve.
Good luck, Steve.
See you guys. Thanks.
Stephen Squires. In fact, we'll be featured in a forthcoming NOVA documentary, Mars, Dead or Alive. It's airing this weekend, Sunday, January 4th. You can check your local listings and actually get a look at that man who has the energy to power a couple of rovers here. I do want to talk a little bit I mentioned I brought it up, Kelly, so I should get you to just sort of fill us in here. There is a way of tracking this on the web. You'll be doing that, won't you?
Right. I mean, NASA has gone out of its way to make this available to the public. You want to start by going to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory's website. If nothing else, just go mars.jpl.nasa.gov. And that will lead you to the right place and time. A lot of this activity will be broadcast, webcast over the net. And, you know, there'll be plenty of opportunities, plenty of press conferences, if nothing else, in the days ahead.
And we will actually have that link on our website. So if you didn't have a chance to write it down, you can find us at theconnection.org.
I would also add that the Planetary Society and their website has some very nice resources for these missions. It's just tps.org, and they have all kinds of additional information and up-to-date bulletins on the situation of the lander. So that's another resource in addition.
Okay, thanks, David. We'll add that to our website as well. I want to go back to just the quick moment of Colin Pillinger's voice we heard at the beginning of the program when he was talking about what the Beagle 2 was going to be able to accomplish. David, you must be feeling that it's pretty rough times for the European Space Agency right now.
Well, yeah, it's kind of sad, but at the same time, you know, you don't want to go too far down that road saying that, because I don't want to sound like I've given up on the mission, because, in fact, I haven't, and it's quite possible. I believe this weekend is going to be the first time that their own orbiter, the Mars Express, will be in a position, having had its orbit optimized, to communicate with that surface lander to make another attempt. And, you know, we don't want to count it out, but still, you know, I feel for those guys because these missions are so long in the making. I mean, it's not just the time since launch, but for years before launch, getting the funding together and getting approval and building the thing. And, you know, that mission in particular was such a ambitious and really bold, kind of audacious mission. It was done on a low budget, and it had a lot of technical innovations. And I'm not going to use the past tense and say if it worked. You know, if it works, it's going to be a very striking mission and very promising. And you know, it's kind of heartbreaking because we don't get many of these opportunities.
If it doesn't work, Kelly, it joins a long list of other failed missions to Mars. In fact, the record of what can send a photograph or data back from that planet is not very encouraging, is it?
Right. I think over the long haul, since the beginning of the space program, it's something like 2/3 of all missions have failed. Now, a lot of those were from the Soviet Union, who would, you know, they were throwing a lot of hardware at the planet that wasn't necessarily optimized for it. But even more recently, with advanced sophistication, I have this little tally sheet here. 9 out of the last 11 missions, not counting Spirit and Opportunity, have...
counting the Beagle 2.
And not counting Beagle 2. All right. 8 out of the last 10. You caught me. Have not performed as they were supposed to. And
right.
It's a challenging place to land. It's a long ways away, as we've pointed out, and so long away that in most cases the landing sequence has to be completely automated so that it's not in direct control from Earth.
And there's a difference.
Now Kelly, were those statistics for all Mars missions or just for landers?
Those are all. Like, you know, Phobos.
Because I think if you look at just the record for landers, of course, they're much worse. We've had a hard time getting landers to work on Mars, and the Russians, of course, were zero for 10 or something.
Right. It's a long and ugly list when you put it all on paper, that's for sure.
So this one, the Spirit, the one that we should be watching for this weekend, it's going down with the same kind of airbag, bubble wrap landing that the Beagle 2 had, that Pathfinder had as well, Kelly?
That's right. It's ironic. After Pathfinder in 97, NASA said, you know, this worked really great, but we're not going to use it again. And suddenly here it is. It seems to be on the top shelf now. Part of this has to do with the fact that NASA lost two spacecraft in the interim, one a lander, one an orbiter, and they tried to do it on a little bit more on the cheap, and they've rebuilt in a lot of rigor that hadn't been on those missions. And I'm not sure. I think the fact that there are two rovers is part of that strategy to just sort of spread the risk.
Well, it certainly is. You know, in a way, that harkens back to the good old days when maybe budgets were a little bit fatter in the post-Apollo years. And it used to be routine procedure at NASA to do two of every spacecraft. We had two Voyagers that went to the outer solar system. We had two Vikings, which were our first successful Mars landers. And then in more recent years, we've been doing one of each. Which, you know, economically really doesn't make as much sense, because if you're going to build one, you might as well build another because you've done all the design work, which is a big part of the cost. So, you know, I think it's a good move to build two, because it really does, you know, any random failure is not going to kill your entire mission if you've got two identical spacecraft.
All right, Connection listeners, why is it that people on this planet are still willing to pour as much money as they are into the search for water or microbial life on other planets? That's something we'll be getting into when we come back right after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. The this hour, a conversation about missions to Mars. Kelly Beatty's here with me in the studio. He's executive editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. David Grinspoon is joining us from where are you, David?
I'm in Chicago.
Chicago, sorry. And I was just, I got a little bit lost because listening to the music from 2001, I'm reminded of the fact that you probably had no choice but to end up in the profession that you're in. Your book, Lonely Planets, tells a story of going to see the Boston premiere of 2001, A Space Odyssey, in the spring of 1968 with the Carl Sagan family.
Yeah, I feel like I did have no choice, actually. I grew up in an environment where space was just in the air, and intelligent life and extraterrestrial life elsewhere was spoken about commonly. And you know, just in a time when, you know, one of my earliest vivid memories is of Neil and Buzz bouncing around the moon when I was in fourth grade, you know, on the television set, and then going to 2001 was this very powerful early movie-going experience. And, yeah, I mean,
You didn't sleep that night, did you, after the movie?
No, I did not sleep that night at all. I kept waking up and thinking that the obelisk was going to be in my bedroom sending me messages. And, you know, so that sort of naturally turned me into a science fiction head, space geek. And then that led to a career in planetary sciences. And then here I am involved in space exploration. And, you know, 2001 is behind us, but we still haven't made contact. We're trying, though.
What is astrobiology?
Well, astrobiology is a recent development in science, which actually has a long heritage. It's a new name, in a sense, for an old quest. NASA was funding something called exobiology, starting really in the 1960s, which, you know, exobiology is the scientific study of the possibility of extraterrestrial life. But when it was exobiology, it was always kind of a fringe thing. NASA supported it, but it wasn't a good career move to be a full-time exobiologist. It was a little bit risky and considered a little bit out there. And then in the late 1990s, it was really interesting to sort of experience this and watch it, because there was a very sudden sea change in attitudes, both in the scientific community and among NASA officials, in terms of the search for extraterrestrial life suddenly became very respectable and very encouraged for mainstream planetary scientists. And it was renamed astrobiology, and NASA formed the Astrobiology Institute out in Silicon Valley and started funding it generously. And so now we have a lot of people that formerly called themselves planetary scientists or other kinds of astronomers or biologists or even geologists who are now all calling themselves astrobiologists in this new interdisciplinary assault on this this fantastic question of trying to figure out with science whether we may or may not be alone in the universe.
And you know, David, as we think back on that sea change, I think there were a couple of underlying reasons for it. One was that paleontologists and biochemists got into the game in a big way. They were discovering that life began on Earth much earlier than had been presumed, and they were trying to figure out why that was in what was obviously a hostile environment. And at the same time, they were also discovering that there is life here on Earth that lives in incredibly harsh conditions, unforeseen in terms of its salinity and heat, temperature, complete disconnection from the sun. And if here on Earth, then why not elsewhere? And that really jump-started the whole science, I think.
Okay, I want to come back to that.
You're right, those. I'm sorry.
I want to come back to that in just half a second, but a reminder to our listeners, this chance for you to join us, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, as we try and figure out this whole sort of life thing. And where Kelly's leading us here, David, is I don't know, maybe in a different understanding of how it is we define life. I mean, at one point, life from outer space was big monsters in an Orson Welles creation, but it has changed and changed and changed again, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And Kelly's absolutely right that these discoveries about life on Earth led us to a much broader idea of where life might thrive. And in all these kinds of locations on Earth that we used to think were uninhabitable, we find something living. Place, you know, hot springs that are where water is above the normal boiling point of water, incredibly acidic environments and caves underground, all these places where you wouldn't expect to find something living. Now we're finding living beings. And so this encourages us to imagine conditions on planets that may not be exactly like Earth, but might be within the realm of the kinds of conditions living beings can endure, because apparently life is much more adaptable and much more tenacious than we had imagined. But, you know, the seminal event that really catalyzed this astrobiology movement, I think the ground was prepared by those discoveries that Kelly mentioned, but the event that really got things going was the Mars rock. And I'm talking about in the summer of 1996, the announcement that fossils had been found in a rock from Mars. Now, this is still very controversial, and a lot of planetary scientists don't buy it, but it was announced with great fanfare, and the President of the United States got involved in the press conference, and there were huge headlines all around the world that people thought they had found fossils from Mars. And this, I think, got everybody in the community going, hey, why not? Maybe there could be fossils from Mars. And whether or not this one finding stands up, I think the legacy of it, in fact, is largely responsible for this new astrobiology movement.
Why is it, Kelly, there has been so much controversy? I'm thinking back to people's interpretation and reinterpretation of the Viking and the Mariner and the debate over whether or not there's stuff in the rock that proves a point. What's missing here? What's the thing that's going to push this from speculation to proof?
Well, Carl Sagan was famous for many things, and one was a statement that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And that just wasn't in this Martian meteorite. It's a meteorite that landed on Earth and was from the surface of Mars, blasted off the surface. It's 4 billion years old, and it had these little vestiges. They looked like microscopic worms, which were interpreted possibly as the fossilized casings of little microbes. Mm-hmm. So the problem is that we haven't yet found, although on paper, life could form in lots of other places. We see that it formed on Earth pretty readily, may have even formed multiple times on Earth for all we know. And so the question is, how do we get that incontrovertible evidence someplace else? Now, the Spirit and Opportunity landers will give us some, you know, circumstantial evidence. They'll look for evidence that water had ponded on the surface of Mars. Beagle 2, we hope it makes it, will be a little more direct. It will be looking for organic materials that are directly related to the past or present formation of life. That will get us closer, and I think perhaps it won't be until we actually get a sample back from one of these places, be it Mars or Europa or Titan. These are other places in the solar system that may have the right conditions that we'll be actually able to say, yes, there is life there.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Ayer, Massachusetts, and Jeff's with us now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you folks? This is a great show, and you can really feel the enthusiasm out here. And listen, everybody listening, give to science, because this is really this is what we need, and we need the young people to be involved. Great show,
Jeff. Let me ask you. I'm going to let you get to your question in a minute, but you're reflecting on the enthusiasm. So, why, in your view, does it matter that this search for life be pursued?
Because we have so many mysteries right here terrestrially. Even out in space, and I really see that if we marry the two together and look for discoveries here that are yet unfounded and out into space, that it just encourages more exploration, more science, and this is what we as humans, I think, kind of thrive on, is finding more about our universe, as well as our own home here. So,
it's like what we're supposed to do, right?
Absolutely. And
okay, to your question here.
I grew up in an aerospace family, too, and you can't help but go through that period of time and just to carry that excitement with you your whole life.
All right, Jeff, I interrupted you. What's your question here?
My question is really two parts. One is, I'm really curious, because of all the organisms, even here on this planet, that are difficult to detect, how you create a detector on a space probe to look for life, you know, if you're an astrobiologist looking for life. And two, how do space programs in an interdisciplinary way look for things here, too? Say in oceanography, why don't we have a bunch of probes crawling around the bottom of our ocean looking for life, as well as then take what we have with that and apply it to the space programs?
David, first to you and then to Kelly.
Yeah, well, those are great questions. And, you know, it is very difficult to look for life elsewhere. We don't even have an ironclad definition of what life is that everyone agrees on. So we do have this sort of paradoxical situation that we're looking for something that we can't entirely define. And it may be that when we find it, that will teach us what the definition is. So it's an unusual kind of science, you know, where we can't frame the question entirely precisely. All we have is the example of Earth life. And so what we have to do is look at the qualities of Earth life and try our best to guess, really, to make educated guesses about which of those qualities are going to be universal attributes of life. And so we come to things like metabolism, that life seems to use energy to build ordered structures, and it seems to reproduce and evolve. So, you know, these kinds of overall qualities, we will look for phenomena that contain these. But it's all kind of educated guessing, and it may be that our ideas about life are wrong. You know, we assume that it's probably carbon-based. We assume that it probably needs water. Certainly all life on Earth needs water. But again, that's all based on one example. So we may be surprised. I mean, that's the whole point of exploration, is to be open to surprise. And any experiment that we actually design does carry certain assumptions about what life is, and we have to keep that in mind.
Kelly,
but at the same time, we can't just sit here and worry about the fact that it's difficult. We have to go and give it our best shot and go look and see what we find.
Yeah, Jeff, to your first point of how do we detect life, you know, we've been down this road before. The Vikings that David mentioned earlier, which landed in 1976, had four little experiments on board trying to detect life. The principal way they did that, they were looking for some evidence that the bugs there ate or drank or somehow had a metabolism. And some of those results are controversial even to this day. There's one experiment that had a fairly positive result. Now, what the Beagle 2 would do, for example, is just look for evidence that these organisms exist. And it does that by looking at the isotopes of carbon. Life as we know it much prefers carbon-12 over the other two isotopes, 13 and 14. And so if you find a sample with a disproportionate amount of carbon-12 in it, eureka, you have some very solid evidence that you've got some sort of biological process going on. So that's how we would right now detect an Earth-style life detector. And as your point about the subterranean oceans, I'd venture that there are more paleontologists and biochemists scrounging around looking for life than there are astrobiologists. Principally, what happens is that you've seen these little submersible vehicles that go to mid-ocean vents and so forth. Those are one good means. Another is that we take cores from all over the seafloor, bring them back to our labs and study them. And when we do that, we find, for example, that there are creatures, microbial creatures, living in rocks that have no connection whatsoever to sunlight. You know, a mile deep in the rock of basalt flows and so forth. And so these studies are showing us that life is truly hardy and may exist in ways that we hadn't really thought of before. That's the challenge, to design experiments that could take in the entire spectrum of possible forms of life, not just the ones we're familiar with.
Tell me, Jeff, in your mind, if you're open to all these different definitions of life that Kelly and David are suggesting.
Oh, I am. In fact, I'm really quite intrigued with this infectious agent that we have now in our planet called a prion, which is basically a protein that replicates itself in brains of, you know, different organisms. And if that would be considered, since it's just a chain of proteins, if that would be considered by an astrobiologist as a life form.
Well, astrobiologist?
Well, I would say we're not going to find something like a prion living by itself on Mars, because it's a life form that can't exist without other life forms that it's sort of preying on. The interesting thing about a prion is that it's just protein. It has no nucleic acid, no DNA or RNA, which we regard, you know, which is the universal hereditary material that life on Earth uses to reproduce itself. So I don't think, you know, I don't expect to find something like a prion that can't exist without it. You know, unless there are prions and also other organisms that they are preying upon. But I would be very surprised to find something that's similar to highly evolved life on Earth, unless it turns out that we are, in fact, related to Martian life, which is a whole other interesting possibility because there's been exchange of material between the two planets.
Now, Kelly, you mentioned a couple of minutes ago Europa, which is one of Jupiter's moons, right?
That's correct.
And a recent source of some question or interest in terms of how we define life. Can you explain what...
Well, if you're one of the three people who saw Kevin Costner's Waterworld, you'd appreciate that this is a place that...
I'm one of them.
And I'm the other. So Dick, was that... Are you the third?
I didn't see that. But he's listening.
Imagine a place that is almost... A world that's almost completely water. And right now, Europa is an ice world, at least as far as we can see. Externally, it has a thick ice crust, and most people believe, though we haven't completely nailed it yet, that beneath this crust of ice is a very deep ocean. And perhaps in that deep ocean is some sort of geothermal activity, and you've been following this program, geothermal activity, heat, you know, ocean, organic nutrients, bingo, you might have the makings for life. So NASA is planning a mission in the coming years that will go to Europa and look in a much harder way than we have now for evidence that this planet is active, this moon is active. I say planet because it's the size of our own moon and very much a world in its own right.
But David, what you're saying is that we are way too stuck on a planet Earth definition of life when it comes to judging what a Martian is or what could be life on Mars.
Well, in a certain sense, we're way too stuck. But, you know, we have to be pragmatic here because in order to do science on the question, we have to, in a certain sense, be more narrow-minded than we might be if we're just thinking about it, you know, philosophizing over a beer somewhere and thinking about all the possibilities. Because we don't really know that life has to resemble Earth life elsewhere in terms of its chemistry and in terms of needing water. But it's one kind of life that we know can exist and we believe probably does exist elsewhere. And we know very specific tests we can make to look for it. Other kinds of life, you know, if we want to be honest, we have to admit, well, we don't know that life has to be so much like Earth life. There could be other chemical bases that have nothing to do with carbon that we just haven't thought of, but we really don't know how to look for those kinds of life. So in a certain sense, we have to voluntarily put blinders on and say, okay, we're going to be narrow-minded and assume that life is just like our life, because that allows us to do science and formulate specific hypotheses and make tests. But at the same time, as we explore, we have to be open to really being surprised and open to finding things that we're not looking for, really. That's the difference between science and exploration. You know, we go out there and we don't always know what we're going to find. So even while we look for these specific isotopic signatures that Kelly mentioned of carbon, we should also be looking for things that are just really strange and weird kinds of chemistry that we don't understand or weird structures that we don't understand. And when we see things that really seem unusual, we should regard them as possible candidates for a new kind of life, while at the same time being really skeptical and not making that assumption until we rule out other things.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Join our conversation speculating on what life would look like from somewhere else. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. With me on the program today, David Grinspoon. He is an astrobiologist, principal scientist at the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado, author of a brand new book called Lonely Planets, The Natural Philosophy of Alien Life. He's joining us from the NPR studios in Chicago. Kelly Beattie is here in Boston with me. He's executive editor of Sky and Telescope magazine, editor of a brand new magazine called Night Sky, coming out this spring. Our number 1-800-423-TALK. Kelly, I'm going to start with you. If any evidence of life was found on Mars, would anybody really care? Would it change anything?
Well, I think that's a terrific question. You know, in our society right now, we've become so inundated with the prospect of life. There are, you know, X-Files and Star Wars, and of course there's life everywhere. I mean, you ask people on the street, I think you would get a pretty resounding positive response there. And so the question is, if we found life, would anybody outside of the scientific community care? Ed Wyler, who's the NASA Associated Administrator for all of this endeavor, said, you know, it would be the discovery of the century, scientific discovery of the century. And perhaps it would be. I'm wondering if people on the street would quite feel the same way. And further, you know, the life that we're looking for is principally a sort of microbial, bugs level kind of life. And I think most biochemists would and paleontologists would certify that it's a huge step to get from one-celled algae and such to the kind of complex life that you see in these Orson Welles science fiction thrillers, mm-hmm. and the kind that might be capable of communicating with us someday.
David, what do you think? Would people care? Would it change anything?
Well, first of all, I agree that everybody already believes there is extraterrestrial life. You know, in working on my book, Lonely Planets, for the last several years, I've been studying attitudes about this. One of the things I did was try to just gauge what people from very different philosophical backgrounds think about extraterrestrial life. And it's very hard to find somebody that doesn't believe there's life elsewhere. I've hardly met anybody that thinks that. But the question, would people care if it were just microbial life? I think that there is a big distinction between finding, you know, somebody to talk to. What we all really want is somebody to talk to, some other intelligent being that sprung out of the same universe that we can compare notes with on the cosmos. But what if we just, I mean, it's much more likely if we find something on Mars, it's just going to be bacteria, pond scum, you know, something that may not seem that exciting. Certainly to scientists, to biologists, to planetary scientists, this would be huge. It really would be the discovery of the century, of a lifetime, maybe of the millennium. As far as impact on the general public, I kind of think that after the huge headlines and the talk shows and everything, people would settle back to their routine existence, and it wouldn't really change fundamentally the way they feel about things and about their place in the universe. But at the same time, I think that if we do find microbes on Mars, it does imply something about our universe. It gives us the first solid hint that our universe makes life rather easily, that there's nothing extraordinary about a planet with life if we find life on the planet next door. And to me, that carries a huge hint that there must be lots of life. And if there's lots of life, then surely there is somebody to talk to not too far away. So if we find microbes that easily by the first planet really we look, then that tells us that this universe is fertile. It makes life. If there's life spread everywhere, then there is going to be intelligent life not too far away in our galaxy. So there's a promise there. There's a promise of more really exciting discovery to come. And I think it ought to give us hope. And that even that hope that there might be, that there probably is someone else to talk to, some other kind of thinking beings somewhere not too far away in our galaxy, I think really can profoundly affect the way we view ourselves and our situation here on Earth. And it can make, for instance, some of our differences that seem so huge between human beings seem rather petty when you consider the difference between us and somebody truly different from a different planet.
From another planet.
And so I
want to stop you there
because
I want to try and make some room for our callers here. And Jerry's been waiting on the line in North Vernon, Indiana. Jerry, thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for taking my call. The difference between microbial life on another planet and those reaching Earth, I mean, it's almost impossible because it'd be burnt up. So how will it affect us and our search to cure diseases that ail us?
If it weren't about finding a cure to an earthly disease, though, Jerry, if it was just about discovery that life existed on another planet, would that make a difference to you?
I would want to get our own house in order before. I mean, if you're just going to discover another periodic table, I mean, an element, what's the goal? I don't understand the goal. Is it just not that we're alone? Well, what does that matter if, you know, we're all dying here?
Well, I mean, Jerry, you raise a good point, and it speaks to, you know, in the broader sense, NASA's asked time and time again to justify why it's doing what it's doing. And, you know, searching for life elsewhere in the universe, I think most people would agree, in and of itself, is a pretty profound question that really needs an answer. It's a question that's been around for a long time. Can discovering life on Mars help us in our quest for, you know, drugs and pharmaceuticals to eradicate disease here on Earth? I have to say maybe, because one of the things that sets Mars apart from the Earth is that it's a simpler system. It's weather. It has weather. It has clouds. But it's a simpler system. Earth is a very complex place. It's often hard to disentangle all the different root causes for things. If you go to a place where life evolves simpler, than it did here, then perhaps we'd have a handle on attacking some of these questions. I'm not saying that's the goal. I think that just trying to decide whether there's life elsewhere in the universe is in and of itself a very proper goal for NASA.
Yeah, I would have to agree. We don't go look for life on Mars in the specific hopes of finding new ways to solve diseases on Earth. But it very well, a discovery like that very well would ultimately help us with that kind of thing because, you know, science involves a lot of serendipity. If we discover life on Mars, just the opportunity to compare alien life, even if it's just microbes, with terrestrial microbes, we would learn so much about life and how it works and how it evolves. And eventually that's going to trickle down to very practical discoveries. And, you know, you can make that argument against all basic research. You know, why do it if we don't have a specific thing where we're trying to make a profit or trying to cure a disease? But, you know, basic research is about curiosity. It's about just trying to learn about the way the universe is. And I think most people support that. Further, I think when we're exploring for life in the universe, I actually think that there's a spiritual component to this. And that's one of the things that so excites me about this topic is that it's scientific. It's a scientific quest, but it's also a spiritual quest. You know, we want to know how we fit into the universe. We want to know what we're doing here on this planet. And if there's really something so extraordinary about life on Earth, or if the phenomenon of life is something that springs forth from the universe, you know, wherever there's a suitable planet. And that the answers to that will tell us, you know, about our very nature, about what we're doing here. And, you know, the thought of spiritual questions that we can actually go out and find concrete answers to, you know, that's very rare and very precious. And if we have the opportunity to do that, I just don't see how we can not do it.
I just want to inject a little pragmatic factoid here. The cost of this ongoing NASA rover mission with Spirit and Opportunity is about $800 million. And that's, you know, $3 per U.S. citizen. I would guess that Steve Squires has every intention of making sure that, if nothing else, we get $3 worth out of enjoyment and curiosity satisfied. If Mars Pathfinder from 1997 is any indication, this mission will be watched by tens of millions of people, not just casually, but very intently. There's something almost anthropomorphic about watching rovers. These are the size of golf carts, small golf carts, roaming around on Mars and doing our bidding for us on another world. I think that's pretty exciting stuff.
1-800-423-8255. Let me go to Apex, North Carolina now. Greg, you're up. Go ahead.
Hi. First, I'd like to say, you know, I have the utmost respect for the guys at JPL and NASA and their compatriots around the world. I think what they're doing is incredibly important. And to backtrack your last caller who kind of said, well, why are we doing this? I don't think there's anything more important. I think that space and exploration of space is not only our destiny, but maybe our salvation in the long run. But to get my question is, if they do find evidence of life on Mars or anywhere else, they think this is going to give a boost, not only socially, but financially, to the space program, and if they think it'll boost the process of actually putting a man on Mars, or was this just going to, you're going to have more manned or unmanned probes going there instead?
Is that something that's even considered, David? Sending?
Yeah. People are definitely considering sending humans to Mars, and both within NASA and then outside of NASA, there are advocacy groups that are very you know, enthusiastic, almost fanatic about the need to send humans to Mars. And, I think, yes, if we find life on Mars, it will be a boost for the space program, no doubt. I mean, life on Mars is the centerpiece question of our Mars exploration program, and our Mars exploration program now dominates our unmanned exploration of the solar system. So if we have that kind of success, I think that we could look forward to. You know, that's not going to end the quest. If we find yes, there's something there, then we're going to want to know a lot more about it, and we're going to want to study it and examine its DNA. And I mean, that the fun just begins if we actually find something. As far as sending humans to Mars, there's a bit of a paradox there, and here we get into some ethical questions. And there is an ethical component to astrobiology, which actually is one of the reasons that I'm so interested in it, because there's an intersection of ethics and science here. You know, how do we go about, what are our responsibilities to other life if we find it? How do we go about exploring the solar system responsibly, making sure we don't inadvertently contaminate another biosphere? If we find life on Mars, for me, that changes the equation about whether or not we should send humans to Mars. I'm not saying we shouldn't necessarily, but I think we have to be very careful. If there is a functioning biosphere on Mars, we have to make sure that we don't, in our ignorance, muck it up. And
right.
That's one of the reasons why we need to do robot exploration before we send people, to learn a little bit more about the environment that we're going to be stepping on so we don't step on something by accident.
Could we have messed it up already?
Well, for example, the Vikings that landed in 75 were completely sterilized before they set foot. The current rovers and landers, Beagle 2, Spirit Opportunity, have not been sterilized, but they're really, really clean. There's a limit, you know, so many spores per square foot kind of limit on what they're allowed to have. I was reading something that, the most likely nearby life is in the feces and food left on the moon by the Apollo astronauts. You can't sterilize a human before you send him or her to Mars. And David's question is a good one. On the other hand, I do think that discovering life on Mars by any means at any level would be the political hurdle that has to be overcome to get that kind of a program, a human exploration program, started. Right now, it's just not in the cards. But if we did discover life there, I think the kinds of activities that the Bush administration is going through right now, trying to figure out what the heck to do with the NASA program in light of the loss of Columbia, will be much more germane. I mean, a lot of people that I've talked to say, losing astronauts wouldn't be so bad if we simply weren't, if we were doing more than just sending them in circles around in a can.
And David, you write about scientific intuition in Lonely Planets. What's your scientific intuition telling you about what's going to be coming back from Mars in the next few weeks?
Well, I actually believe that there is not life on Mars today. And I would be very surprised. I'd be very pleasantly surprised. There's nothing I'd rather be wrong about, than, except maybe the warlike nature of humanity, than my belief that there is no life on Mars today. But I think that we have an excellent chance of finding fossil life on Mars. And what I think these missions will do is further our understanding of what the past of Mars was like. And we have all these indications that in the past, the distant past, billions of years ago, Mars had surface water and probably had a thicker atmosphere that was more protective of surface life. And there's every reason to believe that the kinds of events that led to the evolution of life on Earth when Earth was young also led to the evolution of life on Mars when Mars was young. So I think that we're going to refine our knowledge of the past of Mars and the evolution of Mars, and we're going to hone in on the best places to go and look for fossil life.
I have to stop you there, David. We're out of time. Sure. I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
David Grinspoon, astrobiologist, author of the new book Lonely Planets. Kelly Beatty, thanks a lot for coming in.
Great time as always, Dick.
Kelly is executive editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. Watch for Night Sky coming out this spring, a brand new magazine. We also talked with Stephen Squires, the principal investigator of the Mars Explorer rover project. A reminder that there are links on our website that will allow you to follow the progress of the rover, the Spirit, and the Opportunity. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.